It's Friday, January 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Chinese stocks end in positive territory after a tumultuous week. An analyst says China's economy is in transition.
That transition was always going to be very, very bumpy. And this is being played out to some extent in the stock market.
We look at cybersecurity in the new year. And one of Germany's most controversial books is on sale again. It's all ahead. Chinese stocks drifted in and out of positive territory during the first hours of trading Friday before closing up at the end of the day. The market earlier this week twice triggered a circuit breaker mechanism because of huge losses. The trading halt was intended to calm markets, but it seemed to be having the opposite effect, so Chinese officials suspended the rule late Thursday. I spoke with Alan Wheatley, Associate Fellow in International Economics at the London think tank Chatham House and former Reuters foreign correspondent. He spoke about the failure of the circuit breaker.
It did not work as it was meant to. We should bear in mind that China is not the only country with circuit breakers. They are designed to serve a particular purpose, and in China's case, they clearly did not work. What is disappointing, I think, is that this is the second time in 6 months that the authorities have tried to intervene or interfere with the market clearing process, and they have failed. They've failed to learn their lessons. There is clearly pressure to sell Chinese stocks, and the authorities, which let us not forget, are always determined to try and keep control of events, be they social, political, economic, are standing in the way of that process. Now, having said that, I would draw a distinction between the impact of the stock market turmoil itself and the underlying events. In other words, what's happening in the stock market is a symptom and is not terribly important given the relatively small size of the Chinese market. But it's the underlying causes which I think are a cause for concern.
What are those underlying causes?
Well, China, after 35 years of incredibly impressive breakneck growth, has reached the end of the road for its economic model, which has been dependent on cheap capital, heavy investment, and industrialization with a view primarily to exports. There is a realization that in order to keep climbing up the economic ladder, to keep raising living standards, they need to move towards more efficient production, towards domestic consumption, towards services. They need to have smarter growth. Now, if that were to happen in any country, it would be a very difficult transition to pull off. In a country the size of China, with 1.4 billion people, in a country like China, which is caught in transition between the state, and let's remember the Communist Party still commands the heights of the economy, and on the other hand, a desire to give greater play to market forces, that transition was always going to be very, very bumpy. And this is being played out to some extent in the stock market. But more importantly, I think, we see evidence in the underlying economic fundamentals where China is trying to reduce excess capacity in areas like steel, glass, coal, where they're trying to contain the rise in debt, which has soared since the 2008 crisis. These are all very difficult problems to grasp for China to grasp with. And we, in the rest of the world, are feeling the ripples, if you want, of this phenomenon.
Absolutely. It's been very interesting this week to see how China's economy, I mean, what a huge driver it is on the rest of the world.
Yeah, a couple of things to be pointed out there. There's been a lot of misleading commentary to say that the Chinese industrial economy is shrinking because the purchasing managers' indexes have been below 50. That is simply factually incorrect. A reading below 50 denotes that growth is softening. A reading above 50 denotes that it is accelerating. But even though it is below 50, industrial production is still growing at 6.5%. That is a shadow of what it used to be, but nevertheless shows that there is underlying growth there. Retail sales, as a proxy for broader consumption in China, are still growing considerably at a considerable pace, about 10% a year. The thing to bear in mind is this. The Chinese economy today is about three times bigger than it was a decade ago. So it is unrealistic to expect the economy to keep growing at 10% a year simply because the size of the pie has become so much bigger. Even though China is growing now by less than 7% a year, the additional output that it is generating is much, much greater than it was 10 years ago when the overall economy was growing faster. So this underlines the point I'm making. I think fundamentally the drivers of growth are there, but they are changing. They're changing gears. They're being forced to change gears rapidly, and it is making for a very, very bumpy transition.
That's Alan Wheatley. He's Associate Fellow in International Economics at Chatham House in London. Now for a reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. There hasn't been a tremendous reaction to China's stock market shutdowns on Twitter, but on the social media site Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, people are a little bit more involved. Huileng Tan of CNBC reported that Weibo users are reacting to the latest market shutdown, and according to the article, the hashtag A-Shares Circuit Breaker is being used to talk about the market shutdown. And the Financial Times also reported there's this viral explanation for the circuit breakers that's been going around Chinese social media. This is what the explanation says. You bring 3,000 yuan to a mahjong game and lose it all in just a half an hour. You pause the game for 15 minutes and run to the ATM to take out another 5,000 yuan. Then you go back for more and get wiped out again. Finally, somebody says, your luck is terrible today. Let's call it a day.
Well, what else is trending right now?
One of the biggest social media trends started right here in the United States. Last night, President Obama had a town hall meeting in Virginia to discuss his executive actions on gun control, and people started reacting on Twitter by using the hashtag #GunsInAmerica. The meeting was held very close to the National Rifle Association's headquarters in Virginia, and the White House says it invited the organization to participate in the town hall meeting. The NRA did not physically participate, but its Twitter account was very active during the meeting, basically live tweeting reactions to President Obama's discussions as it was taking place. It tweeted, this is the last tweet, at POTUS doesn't want an intellectually challenging policy discussion. He wanted NRA to be an audience member at his PR stunt. No thanks. Some people responded to these tweets in agreement. Others tweeted that the NRA should have shown up to the town hall meeting. But people across social media are tweeting support and resistance to the president's executive actions.
Thanks very much, Olin. That's International Edition's Olin Akisholu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, JPL, is developing what they call a chemical laptop to help search for extraterrestrial life. The battery-powered device is actually a miniature laboratory that is being equipped to gather and analyze samples in order to detect any material that might be associated with life, such as amino and fatty acids. Once developed, NASA says they'd like to send it out on a spacecraft to a destination such as Mars or Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter. NASA describes the device as a chemical analyzer that's about the size of a laptop computer. And, like a computer, their chemical laptop can be programmed and reprogrammed to perform a variety of functions. The researchers conducted a successful field test of the chemical laptop last year at JPL's Mars Yard, a simulated Martian landscape. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is this international edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf goes on sale in Germany for the first time in 70 years. Well, there's little doubt that 2015 will not be remembered fondly by cybersecurity professionals. With millions of successful hacking attacks and uncounted documents breached or stolen, it seemed at times that nothing could be done to stop the assault on the globe's computer systems. So is 2016 doomed to just more of the same, or might help be on the way? International Edition's Doug Bernard covers cyber for us and joins us now. So, Doug, just how bad was 2015?
I think it's fair to say that it was the worst year that we've seen, whether it was the hack at OPM here at the federal government, the various hacks of insurance companies and that kind of thing. Clearly, 2015 was the year of the data breach. Millions upon millions of documents, very sensitive in many cases, were stolen, in some cases altered. And looking back at the year, it seemed at various times like the cybersecurity professionals just weren't able to really to do anything against it. So I think it was a year of great frustration for a lot of people who were hacked and who were trying to stop the hacking.
Well, why did hacking seem to get so out of control? And the big question, who's responsible?
Well, who's responsible is a multivariate answer. But hacking, I think it got out of control, I think in large measure, you could say, because people just haven't been taking it seriously enough. There are lots of IT people like myself and others who've, you know, been waving the flags and trying to alert people. But those often in charge, whether in government or in private business, haven't really been attentive to this. Well, I think it's fair to say that 2015 got their attention. And I think that is actually a positive trend. If you have boards of directors and elected officials, you know, proactively engaged, looking at not just, the aftermath of a hack, but really pursuing what's being done to prevent them, I think that's a very positive sign.
Well, and more, you know, as I asked earlier, but who's responsible? You keep hearing that maybe it's China,
right.
Maybe Russia.
Right. Well, China certainly has. In fact, China recently, the government did come out and admit that hackers in China were responsible for that OPM hack that stole the personnel records of millions of former and current federal employees here in the U.S. The hacking from China has come down a little bit recently since President Xi Jinping and President Barack Obama announced that agreement earlier this summer. China certainly is a source of it. Russia is a source of it. I think the bigger question is not the nations where it's coming from, but the sources. So we're seeing, I think, three large trends. Organized crime, number one, they're still interested in commodifiable data, credit card numbers, that kind of thing. Governments are very interested in state secrets, and other companies, foreign-based, are interested in getting the intellectual property of U.S. firms.
What reasons are there for optimism?
Well, in addition to, I think, people paying more attention to it, I think 2016, we're going to start seeing more machine learning, or what they call artificial intelligence, being integrated into the protection systems. So rather than humans trying to react to a hack once it happens, what we're actually seeing is the development of machines that begin to kind of study how the hacks happen and proactively begin to, in fact, predict hacks before they happen so they can raise the defenses where they need to. So here you actually have a machine getting involved in the fight against human hackers. And look, machines are just much faster than humans. So I think that's an interesting trend.
Any suggestions for individuals to try and keep themselves safe online?
Sure. Well, the main ones, we say this again and again and again, and yet it can't be said often enough because this is still the primary access route for hacks. First, change your password often. Don't make it an easy one. It can't be your dog's name with a one or an exclamation at the end of it. Don't use the same password between accounts is the second step. Have a different sort of varied list of them. And three, most importantly, if you get an email, if you have an attachment, if you have something that you haven't asked for or that looks fishy in any way at all, delete it. Do not open it. Do not turn back. Do not let curiosity or fear get the better part of you.
Thanks very much, Doug. That's International Edition's Doug Bernard, our cyber correspondent.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The first publicized version of Adolf Hitler's book Mein Kampf went on sale Friday in Germany for the first time in 70 years. The publication, with extensive annotations of critical commentary, was produced by the Munich-based Institute for Contemporary History following the expiration of a copyright held by the state of Bavaria on December 31st. Mein Kampf, written by Hitler following the failed coup known as the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923, is Hitler's often rambling, ultra-nationalist, anti-Semitic, and anti-communist worldview. The publication is intended to provide some historical context for the rise of National Socialism, or Nazism, in Germany. Ernst Piper, a historian at the University of Potsdam, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Hitler's book has been readily available in bookstores and on the Internet, but not printed in Germany. He was asked whether release of the book for the first time since the end of World War II is controversial in Germany.
From time to time, people said we should have an academic edition, and the Bavarian government said no. At the moment, there is a great deal of publicity about this academic edition, but I doubt that it will be have a great impact on the, in the political area. It's not really a controversy, no.
The head of Germany's Central Council of Jews is quoted as saying that Mein Kampf will be important in explaining Nazism and the Holocaust.
I agree. That's exactly the reason why an academic edition always would have made sense. We had all the other writings. You have 40 or 50 volumes of diaries by Goebbels and all these things. And the only book Hitler ever had published was not accessible.
Is there a different view among Germans about the Nazi past?
Of course, the distance is growing. My children, for example, they were born in the 90s. For them, it's pure history, like, First World War or so. It's different to me, but still there's a great deal of awareness. People go to concentration camps and to museums. I think the young generation maybe knows even more than all the previous generations, but they have a different relation, of course. There is no personal impact anymore. For me, it was very different. My parents lived in their time. Yeah, it's different.
I really want to know exactly how it's going to be used. Is it just going to be used as a historical source?
Yeah, that's what I expect. It's really for specialists. It has a low price. I think it will be sold at for €59. So who is interested will be able to afford it, but my expectation is that the interest will be limited.
Where will you be able to buy it?
Probably in every ordinary bookshop, but I doubt if really many people want to read 2,000 pages and more than 50% of that is annotations. It's really for specialists. And we will see what happens in a few weeks' time when we have the first reviews. It's a great deal of discussion at the moment, but I doubt that it will continue because the text was not unknown in the past. And it's also not really fun to read this book. It's boring in a way. It's barely written. It's very elusive. And I would be very surprised if it would become a bestseller.
That's Ernst Piper of the University of Potsdam. Jewish opinion is mixed. The head of Munich's Jewish community expressed concern the publication will awaken interest in Hitler's views. But Professor Dan Michman, who heads the International Institute for Holocaust Research in Israel, has been aware of the project for years and is not afraid of its release.
I'm not afraid of this edition contributing to anti-Semitism or to neo-Nazism, because all of Hitler's writings and speeches and even his second book, which was never published during his life, all have been published and annotated and used in scholarly research and in scholarly teaching, except for Mein Kampf. Only parts of it were published in source editions and so on. And I think it's important to have the entire book now published with a serious apparatus. It is important for the scholarly world.
Do you have any concern about the situation of Jews in Germany with the release of this book?
No, not because of this book. Look, the book itself, we have to know that around 12 million copies were printed during the Third Reich and disseminated all over. So it's not hard to find copies. Those who are anti-Semitic, and there is a rise in anti-Semitism also, they can find the sources also in other places. They don't need this kind of publication. I think all this wave now of interest is because of the end of the copyright. After several months, I think it will fade away. Then we'll have to see what happens, but I don't believe that it will make a change.
That is Professor Dan Amichman. He is at the International Institute for Holocaust Research in Israel. Well, that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States congratulates the people of Venezuela on the seating of their new democratically elected National Assembly. It was a historic day as Venezuela's opposition took majority control of the National Assembly for the first time in 17 years. The press was allowed access to the legislature for the first time in many years, and state TV broadcast interviews with opposition leaders. State Department spokesperson John Kirby called the seating of the legislature an important and necessary step towards fulfilling the will of Venezuelan voters as reflected in last month's elections. The United States believes the new National Assembly can serve an important function in advancing and promoting national dialogue focused on addressing the social and economic challenges facing the Venezuelan people. However, the Venezuelan Supreme Court barred four lawmakers from taking their seats while it probed allegations of electoral fraud. As a result, only 163 of the 167 lawmakers were sworn in on January 5th. The next day, three opposition deputies were sworn in over protests by members from the legislature's minority, who announced their intention to challenge the move. Consistent with the spirit of the Inter-American Democratic Charter, which both the United States and Venezuela have committed to uphold, the United States calls on all parties to respect the independence, authority, and constitutional prerogatives of the National Assembly. In recognition of the installation of the National Assembly and in support of inclusive and meaningful political dialogue, said spokesperson Kirby, the U.S. again calls for the release of all Venezuelans imprisoned for their political beliefs and activities. As President Barack Obama has said, democracy depends not only on elections, but also strong and accountable institutions and respect for the rights of minorities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage. at www.voanews.com/editorials.